Good to be up here once again doing the study. Honor and privilege as always. So we've got Judges chapter 17 tonight. What do you say for an intro about this chapter? You know, kind of a tone shift, to be sure. As Austin alluded to in his prayer, a little bit weird, a little bit odd. Lauren, do you remember where we stopped off?
I answered the last one.
Okay. All right, then we'll start with Malan for question number one. So this is after Samson, chapter 16. You know, his story is concluded. Now we find ourselves with a man named Micah and his mother. So the question number one for Malan. Are there any indications in this account of when it has taken place? What had Micah done with his mother's silver? How much is 1,100 shekels of silver worth? Verses 1 and 2.
So, I mean, it appears from the reading that the time period is maybe after the death of Joshua, I think is what I was figuring, the time before the judges. I think that's because in verse 6 it says there was no king in Israel. And I think that's right. I'm not sure if you wanted to hear what someone else has to say on that. The second part, I couldn't really find out what he did with his mother's silver. So I guess I'll leave that open to somebody else. And then the last part, 1,100 shekels of silver. And it appears this would be, I kind of calculated, it would be about 24 pounds of silver. And so in today's, it would be like $7,000 or $8,000. But back then, it would have been, you know, said in our chapter, actually, 10 shekels of silver would be like what he was going to pay the guy. So it would be close to probably a year's salary for them. But, it would be a lot for back then. That's pretty much all I have.
All right, thank you. Anyone else want to answer some of these questions here?
Four. So the first part is kind of along with the mail, and you said a lot of the commentators thought it might be in the days of Othniel, you know, the very first judge. This, you know, before Dan moved to the north. And 1830, chapter 18, verse 30, it says, a Levite was the son of Jonathan of Gershom. So there's speculation that it might be the great-grandson, Moses. So I, like Malan also, I got the price of silver last week was $20.90 an ounce, so it was $9,020. Because a shekel is 24 ounces. But using the other calculation of, I made an estimation of what, so this guy worked for 10 shekels, so that he got paid that every year, but he also got to change the clothes and room and board, so I just guessed that, you know, if you were going to pay a young guy that, you know, what would he have to have? Spending money, and I figured $10,000, so that's $1,000 a shekel, so that's $1,100,000. Use that calculation.
Nice. Yeah, we hadn't done any calculations in our study about, you know, what that would look like in our money. I was kind of thinking like Austin, you know, whatever we pay Austin, calculate that out. not that he's an idolatrous priest or anything, but
there you go, food for thought.
Anyone else on question number one? Dad?
Yeah, because the other side of the coin, as far as when is the account taking place, I know most of the commentators said that it was early on in the period of the judges. But having said that, the Danites move because of what's about to happen in chapter 17 and 18, right? They move up. Yeah, there's a map there. So they move from Dan down on the coast, way up on the other map. You can see there's Dan up there. So the Danites move. So the question is, what was Samson doing down in the territory of Dan in the previous three chapters? And there is no absolute indication in this text that it had to be in the time of Othniel, way back at the beginning. And when it says that he's the grandson of Moses, that in biblical terms, that just means he's a descendant. It says he's the son, it literally says he's the son of Moses, is what it says. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that he was, there were 400 years of captivity. And so for him to be the grandson of Moses, he would, you know, he'd have to be pretty old, and it says it's a young man. So I think that this could, there's no reason why this couldn't be chronological. There's no reason why this could not be happening after the death of Samson. Samson dies. The Philistines, while they're rebuked by Samson, they're not defeated by Samson. And maybe the Philistines decided to push Dan. See, if you notice on the map, Philistia is right south of Dan there. And so it makes sense that Philistia decides Samson was a Danite. We're tired of the Danites. And now we're going to push the Danites out of their territory. And the Danites have to move north. And then the other thing about how much of this, how much it's worth, the mom uses 200 of the 1100 to make an idol, and apparently it was the awe and majesty of Ephraim. Everybody came from miles around to see this silver idol. So this was an impressive thing. So this, it's a large amount of money. And I don't know if this is incidental to the account, but how much did Delilah get paid to betray Samson? It was 1,100 shekels times five. She got, the Bible, for whatever reason, in the account of Samson, says that the five lords of Philistia paid her each 1,100 shekels. So the two accounts make this betrayal, because this is a betrayal fee, right? I mean, this is a sinful fee. They make the sinful, the two accounts, the two narratives make it the same amount. So it's a strange, strange oddity. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Anyone else before we move on to question number two? All right. This will be for Dad, as you just sat down. It's time to stand back up. Question number two. Why did Micah's mother dedicate the silver to be made into a graven image? Why did she say that it will be dedicated to the Lord when it is such an obvious departure from the law of Moses?
Well, she's obviously a sinful person. I think this indicates the nature, of course, the writer, probably Samuel, says right here that people did what was right in their own eyes, right? So this is indicating the sinful nature of what people were doing at this time. She is thrilled because her son, obviously this is a very wealthy family. 1,100 shekels of silver is stolen by her son. He returns it to her. She is overjoyed and thrilled to have her 1,100 shekels back. And then she dedicates it to the Lord. And that word Lord there is the tetragrammaton, the I am that I am. So she's using the name Moses learned from the Lord and referring to God. So this is the personal, she uses the personal name of God. And she uses this 200 shekels out of this fee to make a carved, molded image. And then gives it to her son. And why does she do this? Well, it was strictly forbidden, as the questions indicate, strictly forbidden by God in numerous places. Exodus is a violation of one of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, verse 4. Deuteronomy 4, in several places, says that this is a great sin against God. And the course they knew this, because it was Jewish history just a few years before. If this takes place, if this takes place at the beginning of the Judges period, it hadn't been more than 40 or 50 years since Aaron had made a molded calf and the people had danced around the base of Mount Sinai to a molded calf. And then they had failed at Kadesh Barnea, and all of that generation died wandering through the wilderness. And so if that had just happened 50 years ago, how could she not know that making a molded image is a sinful thing? She's violating God's law that he gave on the Mount of Sinai. So it's a terrible thing that she's doing, but it's a departure from the Lord that we see throughout the history. She's not the only person doing it, obviously. There are other people doing this, but this is perhaps the most egregious. You know, we have studied in recent previous chapters how the people, Gideon's family, for example, had erected altars to Baal and Ashtoreth in their yard, right? And so God said to Gideon, destroy those altars. This is an altar to the God of Israel. A false altar. This is syncretism. This is a false altar to God. And God made it very clear that he hates it. So it's very terrible.
Anyone else? Bill?
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the value of all that silver. I'm just kidding.
More estimations.
You know, Micah's mother, verse 5, she knew that he had a shrine in the house. And she already knew this stuff was going on. And he comes forward with, I stole the $1,100. And I like that in verse 4, we see that she didn't give him the money back. She took the money to the silversmith to get these graven images made. So this guy, Micaiah, he's not a good guy. And I like Bart's point, because I think he's right on. Now Micaiah is a big shot. He's a big shot in the area. He's got his own Levite priest that we're going to secure about here shortly.
All right, anyone else for question 3? Austin?
You know, I kept scratching my head as to why, because there doesn't seem to be any, like, motivation for her to do this. It really comes out of the blue. But as she says there, before the money had been stolen, she had already dedicated the money for this purpose. So it's interesting. I can, you know, speculate as to why she's coming up with this, but maybe it's just a really simple reason that we still see at large today in the religious community, is that, yes, they are serving the one true God. They know who God is, and they know the law, because they get a Levite priest, and they think that that's going to make that they have a, he's going to have an ephod. We'll talk about that in a moment. But they have all of the necessary things, and yet they still make an idol. And maybe it's just because they want to, and that's their way of tweaking and altering the worship of God to their liking in a way that, yes, they are sacrificing something. It's not that they're not giving up something. It's not that they're necessarily doing it out of... I think there's probably some selfish ambitions there, but I would assume if you were to ask them, no, I'm giving this to the Lord. This is my service to God. And we hear that a lot from denominations, from a lot of people out there who genuinely think that they're giving something to God. They genuinely think that they are serving God, and they're just not. It's idolatry. It's the epitome of what Jesus says in Matthew 7. Depart from me, ye who work lawlessness. Even though they cast out me, have we not done all these wonderful things in your name? No, you work lawlessness.
Yeah, that's great. We talked at length about that in our study at home, just about all the perversions, you know, of God's Word and the additions of people. We talked about the Catholic Church as being, you know, one of the main proponents of that, just adding all kinds of unnecessary things that God has not commanded. So, yeah, very good. For question number 3, this will be for Landon. And it's, what can we learn about Micah from all the items that were in his house? Why did Micah consecrate his son to be a priest? And how does verse 6 describe the spiritual state of Israel at that time?
Well, I think for this first question, we've pretty much already answered it. His dad quoted as the passage that we read, that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And that's exactly what's going on here. His mom went and made an idol, and we see Micah here has the same attitude. He's going around, he's got an ephod, he's got a shrine, and he's just an idolater. We talk about the perversion that's happening in Israel at this state, and how paganism, the Philistines, all the other peoples that are there have just destroyed what God is supposed to mean to the Israel people. And now they have demeaned him to the point of worshiping him in small little idols. And of course, we know that Israel at this current point in time is just idolatrous and paganistic. As for the second question, why did Micah consecrate his son to be priest? Well, it seems he's quite infatuated with the idea
of the temple. He's kind of creating his own theme park. He's got an ephod, he's got a shrine, and what would be better than a priest? And so he makes his son a priest, and he's got his temple going. He's got his theme park ready to go. He's ready for those tourists to come and visit what he's got going on. He'll make an improvement to the tourist location later, because he'll get an actual Levite to be a priest. So we can see why he did this. He's trying to make, you know, what Israel used to do, but obviously in the wrong ways. He consecrated his son, but he's not even a descendant of Aaron. We know that Aaron's sons, like the direct descendants of Aaron's, were the only ones to be priests. And he went ahead and consecrated his own son. So everything he did was completely unscriptural, and he should have even been put to death if the law was still being followed. And I've already answered the third question. How does verse 6 describe the spiritual state? Well, everyone's doing what they want to do. It's complete pandemonium. And at times like this, it won't happen again, but at times like this in earlier parts of the book, this is when the judge would appear.
The carnival has come to town. You so eloquently put it. All right, anyone else on question number 3? Warren?
So, the C part, how does verse 6 describe the spiritual state of Israel? So we see that they're corrupted spiritually. And where this is placed in the book, whether it happens way early in the Judges or later on, what we see later on in the book is very dark moral corruption, mayhem, and so forth. So this kind of shows how that progresses from corruption spiritually to very dark moral decay.
Yeah, we talk about that all the time, how, you know, just the corruption of morals and the lack of any and all principle, you know, that just leads to a decay of society, and it's happening to them here. And we've already seen that, you know, studying through Judges. And you know, I've been talking with my boss, Brian, about that actually at work, you know, just the way the cycles a civilization goes through, you know, and how ungodliness just leads to its undoing. So really appreciate that point. Dad?
Yeah, one of the things we talked about was that Micah wasn't the first guy to make a weird ephod idol. There was a judge named Gideon who was a judge named Gideon who he made an ephod. Back in chapter 8, Gideon said, "I would make a request of you that each of you would give me the earrings from the plunder." So they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. And they said, "Well, we'll gladly give them." They spread out a garment, each man threw his earrings from his plunder. The weight of the gold earrings requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, the size of the ornaments, pendants, purple robes, and so on. Then verse 27, Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in the city Ophrah. And all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. So, if this is before Gideon, in the time of Othniel, Gideon is duplicating Micah. Or, if this is after Gideon, after the time of Samson, this guy is doing what Gideon did. So even a judge made an ephod, and then the people later worshipped it and played the harp. So, it's a bad thing.
Awesome.
To that point, as far as the placement of it in the book, I tend to think of it going on earlier, and the reason why it's listed here, why it's listed at all, is the fact of the impact that it had on the history of Israel. So just like Mark said there, if this is happening before Gideon, then Gideon maybe was inspired by Micah to do this type of a thing. And it would really explain, if this is going on earlier in the time period, why Israel kept falling back to idolatry. Why they kept, even though they were saved by one true God, why did they keep going back to idols? Well, it's obvious here, he already had a household idol, a teraphim. And so it would make sense if this is kind of the origin of false worship or tainted worship such that they would devalue God around the nation, and it would make more sense as to why this account is in here if that's the type of impact that it had on the nation of Israel. That's an opinion, but I think it's worth it.
I think that's worth it. Anyone else for a new one? All right. Let's move on to question number 4, which will be for Len or Levi. Just how could someone be of the family of Judah and still be a Levite? What are some possible explanations of the Levite's departure and limited life goals? Why might he have come to the house of Micah?
Yeah, so maybe be the family of Judah and still a Levite. This one I kind of stumbled around a little bit, so here's something from Kaufman, I think. And this sounds reasonable here. He says, the reference to Judah does not signify that he descended from that tribe, but simply denotes that he belonged to the particular group of Levites who had been assigned to Judah, thus being reckoned among matters as belonging to that tribe. So there's something put out there. I don't know much about that. But, what are some possible explanations of the Levites' departure and limited life goals? So we don't know a whole lot about this guy, but he's just traveling around. He's going around, making his rounds. Dad kind of painted a picture of this young guy who wants to go on an adventure, and he's just kind of restless, wants to leave his area. As far as limited life goals, I'm not sure, too sure on that. Why he came to the house of Micah? Lennon was talking about that, how it's like a tourist type area, and obviously he wasn't going in there for any type of judgment. He knew there was a big idol in there, and he obviously wasn't too principled of a person, so he just goes in there to check it out.
Yeah, we talked a bit in our study about how he's a Levite, so Levites are reliant upon the people to make donations, you know, provide for their well-being. Well, if the people are godless and they're not making donations, you know, perhaps he's striking out on his own here because he's not getting any support at home. So, food for thought. Anyone else? Question number 4. Yep, Dad.
Just this is sort of off the questions, but Bethlehem makes an appearance here. And Bethlehem is the city from which Jesus comes, and it's also the city from which King David comes. And it's a tiny little city, almost inconsequential in the history, except for the king and the Messiah are born there. And this, of course, was written long before King David, and it was certainly written 1,000 years before Jesus. And it was written before the prophet Micah wrote the prophecy. You remember the prophecy, out of you, Bethlehem of Ephrathah, little among the nations, or little among the Israel, shall come the Messiah. So Micah the prophet wrote in Micah 5 verse 2 about the coming of the Messiah from Bethlehem. And that's a great way to remember where that prophecy is located, because it's Micah the idolater in this chapter. Mm-hmm. They both have the same name. The name means who is like God.
Thank you. Anyone else? Before we go on to question number 5. All right. So question number 5 will be for you, Cole. Why did Micah want this man to be his priest? What did Micah offer him? And how did Micah feel about the Levite after taking the position?
Right, so Micah, he's got his theme bar going. And this Levite comes out. This would be his new main attraction.
Yeah.
But really, because the Levite priests were the ones who were supposed to be priests, so that just makes it seem more holy. It's kind of a mask onto this altar temple and altar worship to make it seem more righteous. And having that would bring more people, which would mean more donations, which would mean more money for Micah.
Yeah.
And then for part B, he offered him 10 shekels silver, a suit of clothes, and sustenance. And then for part C, He's obviously really happy with it. He said that he followed him as a son. And it was interesting to think that his actual son, Micah's actual son, was the priest within this actual, well, Levi, who just comes around. So maybe, I don't know, his son gets booted and then Micah starts treating this Levi as an actual son.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get too many details, but you can kind of see the narrative of this whole gambit that he's running, you know. And his mother isn't really brought back into the picture. You know, she has her bit at the beginning, but you kind of got to wonder, like, what kind of hand does she have in this? Does she have a hand at all? I mean, she funded the idol, so I don't know. Anyone else? Question number 5. All right, let's move on to the final question. So for question number 6, why did Micah think that God would be good to him with a Levite as a priest? What can we learn from this account about the dangers of perverting the worship of God? That'll be for you, Austin.
Well, the last part of that, or the last question there, I think we've kind of covered. But it's still worth covering again, I suppose. Micah thinks that God will be good to him because, again, as we've stated, he genuinely thinks he's worshiping God. We're setting up a worship to God. There was a quote by Clark, I think, that I had up here as far as what he was doing. He was building a chapel in imitation of the sanctuary. He makes a graven image, he says, representing the ark. Molten image to represent the mercy seat, the teraphim, to represent maybe the cherubim above the mercy seat, and the ephod in imitation of the sacred oval garments. And then, of course, he sanctifies his son to be perfect. I can't help but feel a little bit sorry for his son in this whole gambit, because your father, thinking about it this way, your father sets up this fake religion just out of the blue, and he consecrates you to be his priest, and then the first guy that comes along that happens to be a Levite, he raises him up, he loves him like a son, and apparently he's kicked out of the priesthood. So I don't know how to feel about that, I guess, but he kind of gets the short end of the stick there. But again, Micah genuinely feels like he's worshiping God. And it's not that he doesn't know the law to the extent of he knows that you have to have, that Levites are legitimate priests. He knows that much, at least. And he thinks that that's enough. That as long as you have some correct aspects of religion and you incorporate a few of those in there, that's what constitutes true God-fearing religion. And it's not. In fact, it makes it all the more hilarious, all the more crazy and idolatrous even, to mix truth in with a lie, right? So, obviously, we'll see in the next chapter, it means a lot to the Danites that he's a Levite, and they take this this false religion and run with it. But yeah, it's obviously false, and he thinks it's a good thing, and he thinks everything's going well for him, and little does he know, I guess.
Yeah. And we see that today with modern religion. We've already kind of touched on that, but it became acceptable in this time period because the standards had been so far removed or so lower, I mean, think about if there was a judge running around, this wouldn't happen, It's because, as verse 6 says, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. But this was acceptable. And no one has any standards. They're coming to just see what's going on. So, I really appreciate that. Anyone else on question 6? Dad?
I have a question just for everybody that we can discuss afterwards. Micah says to this young guy, so Micah's middle-aged, because he's got a son of his own who's acting as a priest. Micah's an old dude, middle-aged old dude. And he says to this young Levite, you could be a father and priest to me. You see it in the next chapter, too. The Danites say the same thing to this Levite. You can be a father to us and a priest. And my question for everybody is, are there any references in the Old Testament to where priests are called fathers? Obviously, that's a modern thing. in the Catholic Church, you call the priest father. Jesus said in the New Testament, don't call any man father. And I searched for father and priest in the text, and I couldn't find any other aside from these two references in Judges. And so I'm just curious if anybody else, if this is something new, calling the priest father, or if there's some sort of reference in the Mosaic system of a priest as a father, because it just rings very odd to me that this particular verbiage is picked out, and maybe there's some reference to priests being fathers. I'd just be curious if anybody is like, oh yeah, back in so and so.
All right, anyone else? Awesome.
Just to take a shot at that question, that is a really good question. I didn't think of that. John Gill has it as a father, as in more of a father-like figure to instruct him in the knowledge of divine things. And he says, so prophets were called fathers and their disciples their sons. I don't know about that. I think that's stretching it a little bit. The other option that's kind of come to my mind is just pagan idolatrous worship. And he's incorporating the verbiage ever so slightly, ever so subtly, into the false religion that he's given. Those to me would be the two top answers to that, but that's a good question worthy of a lot of consideration.
Yeah, we brought up the Catholic Church again, referring to your command, if you want to say commanding officer, father. So, anyone else before we close tonight? All right. Well, appreciate everything that's been said. Pretty short chapter, but definitely an interesting chapter. We've kind of begun the descent, as it were. Well, I guess you could say in previous chapters we were descending, but then we come back up, back into a good standing of God and the following. But here from on out.